You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 78, Free Haiti. Thanks for joining me. Before we get started, I'll remind you once again that you can listen to this and all future episodes ad-free by pledging at least $2 a month on Patreon.com. Anyway, we left off last time in late 1798 with the evacuation of the last British troops from Haiti. After 5 years of bloody struggle, Republican forces led by Toussaint Louverture had finally succeeded in expelling the invaders from their land. It had been 7 years since the outbreak of the Great Slave Rebellion. The insurgency had taken a winding course. Leaders had risen and fallen. The rebels had jumped into bed with the Spanish, and then Toussaint Louverture had led most of them into an alliance with their former enemies, the French colonizers. Against all odds, the rebels had achieved most of their aims. Slavery was abolished, along with the racial caste system. Black and mixed-race people were finally on equal legal footing with whites, and non-white people had attained positions of real power and influence. It was a remarkable achievement. More than remarkable, it is actually unique. No other slave rebellion in history, from Spartacus to Nat Turner, has ever succeeded in securing abolition. But for most Haitians, the victory was bittersweet. 7 years of rebellion and war had practically destroyed the country. There are no exact figures, but it's possible somewhere around half the population of the country had died. The economy was in shambles. Perhaps it would be more accurate to say the economy no longer existed. The ravages of war and the destruction of the cash crop plantations had led to an almost complete breakdown. Basic goods were practically impossible to find on the open market, even food. Most people were reduced to consuming whatever they could produce themselves. Even military officers and government administrators were living on the brink of starvation. The bigoted laws and social conventions which had once divided the population were gone. Toussaint Louverture and his allies loudly proclaimed that this was the dawn of a new era, that Haitians of every race and every belief were now united as citizens, pulling together for the good of all. It was a beautiful vision, but as we'll see in this episode, old prejudices and old divisions still lingered under the surface. The leaders of Free Haiti had their work cut out for them. After British forces left the colony, Toussaint Louverture wrote, quote, "I have finally succeeded. I have finally reached the goal I had set myself, namely to chase the English out of Haiti, and replace the banners of despotism with the flag of liberty and the standard of the French nation. I have nothing else to desire." End quote. A fine sentiment, but it wasn't exactly true. As I hope I've demonstrated in past episodes, Louverture was much more than a military figure or a guerrilla warrior. He had been a political operator from the very beginning. He had ambitions to lead his people in peace, just as he had led them in war. Last episode, we covered Toussaint's rise as a military commander, from a novice who was one of many leaders of a ragtag rebel band, to the undisputed commander-in-chief of all Republican forces in Haiti, widely acknowledged as a military genius. In this episode, I'd like to trace his development as a political leader. In early 1796, in the middle of the struggle against the British, Louverture was appointed lieutenant governor, deputy to his personal friend and political ally, Governor Étienne Laveau. This was quite an honor, but not much more than that. The position was basically powerless. Still, the fact that the French felt the need to make this gesture was a sign of Toussaint's massive political influence. In late 1796, Governor Laveau left Haiti, never to return. By now, he had been elected deputy to the National Convention, the ruling legislature in Paris. Haiti was now legally part of France, and it was entitled to representation in the National Legislature, and Laveau had been elected to one of these seats. At first, he decided to stay in Haiti. He still held the position of governor, and it was obvious that he was needed in the colony to play his part in the desperate struggle to drive out the British. But by 1796, the Haitian Republicans were receiving troubling reports from Paris. The Jacobins had been overthrown. Robespierre and his allies had gone to the guillotine, and the new government was pivoting away from their radical policies. What historians call the Thermidorian reaction was in full swing. Unfortunately for the Haitian Republicans, one of the Jacobin policies reversed by the Thermidorians was the hostility to the pro-slavery colonial lobby. The Jacobins had a philosophical hostility to slavery, which was compounded by the fact that so many slaveholders held conservative and royalist political views. To the Jacobins, a slaveholder was just another variety of oppressor, and the Jacobin mission was to exterminate all oppressors. The Thermidorians took a different view. They were not the types to let a little thing like ideology get in the way of doing business and making money. After the Thermidorian reaction, doors that had once been closed to the colonial lobby were suddenly open. The planters found sympathetic ears in government once again. Their agents were once again free to propagandize against black civil rights. Pro-slavery propaganda was flying off the presses. The chief focus of this propaganda was the massacres of whites in the early months of the Great Slave Rebellion in 1791. Even today, if you search for the Haitian Revolution online, many of the top results are depictions of innocent-looking white planters being abused and slaughtered by inhuman-looking rebels. These images are often presented as eyewitness accounts, even though they were printed in Europe or the United States, at the behest of rich planters with a political agenda. As we know, scenes like this did occur during the opening weeks of the rebellion. They were quite terrible, there's no two ways about it. However, according to the propaganda produced by the colonial lobby, this was the sum total of the rebellion. There was never any depiction of the subsequent years of struggle, of the rebels' embrace of Republican ideals, and the creation of a multiracial revolutionary army. Someone who read these propaganda pamphlets would never have guessed that thousands of white and mixed-race men had happily volunteered to serve under Toussaint Louverture, that the vast majority of the population of the colony were now united, whatever their color, in a common cause. There was certainly never any mention of the brutal violence the planters had inflicted on their slaves for over a century, or any of the abuse or injustice which had provoked the rebellion in the first place. Again and again, propaganda of the colonial lobby hammered home two themes. First, that black people were lawless and violent, and could not be trusted with personal liberty. And second, that the planters of Haiti had been victims of a great crime and deserved restitution. The facts that undermined this narrative were downplayed or denied. As I've mentioned in previous episodes, the big white planters of Haiti were some of the wealthiest people in the world, even after the destruction of their estates and the ruin of their business ventures. They still had the resources to spread this highly misleading version of events all over the world. Even today, their propaganda still colors public perceptions of Haiti and its revolution. And it was certainly having an impact in post-Thermidor Paris. The Haitian Republicans needed someone within the halls of power in Paris to hold the line against this resurgence of the big white planters. Someone with impeccable anti-slavery credentials, whose loyalty to the cause was beyond doubt, and someone whose words would carry weight among the white, educated bigwigs of post-Thermidor France. Governor Laveau was the only person in Haiti who really fit the bill, and so the two friends said goodbye. This left a vacancy for the position of governor, and that vacancy was filled by a familiar figure, Commissioner Léger Félicité Sontenax, the man who had abolished slavery in a fit of desperation in 1793, became Governor Sontenax. Louverture and Sontenax had never really gotten along. If you'll recall last episode, Toussaint had praised his friend Laveau for never condescending to black people. The same could not be said of Sontenax. For his role in the abolition of slavery, Sontenax saw himself as the savior of the black race. Quite literally, he talked about himself in those terms. It can be hard to discern Sontenax's true views. He was the type of person who said whatever he thought people wanted to hear in the moment. You might say that's no surprise, he was a lawyer turned politician, but many of his fellow revolutionaries shared that background, and few of them were as slippery as Sontenax. Although he was a vocal opponent of slavery, unlike Laveau, he did not view blacks and whites as equals. Yes, he believed black people were human beings, but he also believed they needed the guiding hand of enlightened white civilization. And as you might guess, he imagined his own hand would be doing that guiding. The consensus among historians seems to be that Sontenax's ambition was to create an autonomous administration for Haiti under his control, effectively turning the colony into his personal fiefdom, with Toussaint acting as his muscle. Despite the quotation we read at the beginning of the episode, where Toussaint claimed he had no ambitions beyond expelling the British from Haiti, we know he hoped to exercise political power after the war was won. That put Louverture and Sontenax on a collision course. At the beginning of Sontenax's administration, the two men tolerated each other. After all, there was a war on. Both of them believed in the cause, and both of them knew their future ambitions depended on victory. Toussaint had two titles, deputy governor and commander-in-chief of the Army of Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was still officially known. His military authority was absolute. He was the senior commander of all Republican forces on the island, bar none. But his civilian title was mostly ceremonial. On paper, Sontenax had all the power in the government, and he aimed to use that power to marginalize Louverture. Sontenax attempted to build up a cult of personality around himself as a great emancipator, the savior of the blacks. He countermanded Toussaint's orders and tried to insert himself into military affairs. Things got personal when Sontenax had Louverture's old mentor, François Bayon de Libertas, arrested as a royalist sympathizer. The charge was ludicrous. It was true that Bayon had fled the island for the United States, but in his exile, he had been a vocal supporter of Louverture. He had even sent his sons to serve in the Republican Army. They were prominent members of Louverture's general staff. His arrest was a pretext to force Louverture to come to the capital and humiliate himself, begging for Bayon's life. Toussaint had no choice but to go along. Bayon was spared, but Louverture did not forget the insult. The conflict between the governor and the general came to a head in the summer of 1797. Despite Sontenac's best efforts, Toussaint was still first in the hearts of the Haitian people, and commanded near-absolute loyalty from the military. An open showdown between the two men would inevitably result in victory for Louverture. And so, in a tense private meeting, Toussaint laid out an ultimatum to Sontenac. The governor would announce his resignation or be destroyed. Sontenac had little choice but to accept. At least, that's what he told Louverture to his face. Sontenac either changed his mind or had never intended on keeping his word. After the meeting, he organized his supporters to put on violent demonstrations against his resignation, hoping to create the impression that there was a groundswell of popular support for his continued rule. Perhaps he really was delusional enough to believe he had cultivated some constituency among the population. Whatever the case, Sontenac would be disappointed. These disturbances were quickly crushed, and the now ex-governor was firmly escorted by armed guards onto a ship bound for France. An unceremonious farewell for the man who had once fancied himself the savior of the black race. Upon his return to France, Sontenac discovered he had few friends. Before he left for Haiti, he had been a member of the Girondin faction, and they had been out of power since 1793. 4 years is an eternity in revolutionary politics. Sontenac's old patron, Jacques-Pierre Brissot, had gone to the guillotine. His peers were all either dead or totally marginalized. The conservatives hated him for his rough treatment of the planters, and the radicals hated him for his Girondin associations and his clashes with Louverture. And of course, he was a major villain in the propaganda being churned out by the planter lobby, which smeared him as a dangerous tyrant. In short, the French didn't want him any more than the Haitians did, and so the self-styled savior of the blacks faded into obscurity. Sontenac's exile left Toussaint as the absolute ruler of Haiti, in all but name. There was no other center of power on the Haitian political scene. From the colonial administration to the army, down to the local councils and municipal governments, everyone was Toussaint's man, at least in public. Louverture proved to be just as energetic in civilian affairs as he was in military matters. Even after the British withdrawal in 1798, he continued his habit of touring around the country and ruling from the road. Wherever Toussaint and his entourage stopped for the evening, the local people were invited to audiences with the great general. Every night, he held private meetings with 60 ordinary citizens, 30 men and 30 women. By listening to the people's concerns, offering them help, granting small favors, Toussaint was building loyalty and burnishing his reputation as a man of the people. And he was also keeping informed. There was no public opinion polling and no focus groups in the 18th century. If a ruler wanted to keep his finger on the public pulse, he had to actually listen to the people. I don't know of any other leaders from this era who spent more time engaging with the public on a personal level. Louverture was a master communicator. With the common people, he spoke in Creole, or in Fon, his parents' native language from Africa. He used a lot of Catholic religious imagery, and peppered his speeches with homespun Creole sayings and traditional Haitian proverbs. For more educated audiences, he switched to French, and used a lot of classical allusions, and emphasized the shared republican ideals, which the French and Haitian revolutions held in common, and which united all the people of the colony. He would need all his political skills for the task now facing him. 7 years of rebellion, civil war, and foreign invasion had left devastation on a scale rarely seen before the advent of industrial warfare in the 20th century. As I mentioned earlier, it's possible that as much as half of the population of the colony had died during the struggle. Many of those who were left had been uprooted from their homes, gone to fight, or fled as refugees. Both of the colony's major urban centers, Port-au-Prince and Cap-Français, had suffered major fires during the war and been almost completely destroyed. As we've discussed in earlier episodes, in the early phases of the rebellion, the insurgents made a habit of burning plantations. This was a very effective tactic, but in doing so, they had destroyed the only economic engine of the colony. It's hard to overstate the importance of cash crop agriculture in Haiti. It was the only significant source of foreign trade. All economic activity in the country was secondary to the exports that came out of the plantations. And thanks to the disruptions of war, those exports had almost totally ceased. Coffee exports were down to 2.8% of what they had been before the revolution. Sugar, 1.2%. Cotton, 0.7%. And indigo, 0.5%. What had once been the most profitable colony in the world had almost entirely ceased exporting the goods which had made it rich. As a result, in many parts of Haiti, the economy had totally collapsed. Quite literally, there were regions where money was no good. Basic necessities like food, clothing, and shelter were in such short supply that they could not be purchased on the open market. Louverture had to find some way to restart the economy and reopen international trade, without resorting to the violence and domination of the old slave system, and without angering France, which on paper should have been Haiti's main trading partner, but in practice was impossible to reach through the British blockade. It was quite a tall order. Restarting the economy meant getting the plantations working again, but obviously this was an incredibly sensitive proposition. We've covered the horrible conditions of the pre-revolutionary plantations in great detail in past episodes. Suffice it to say that after a painful 7-year struggle to be freed from those conditions, nobody in the colony was eager to return to plantation labor, even as free citizens. Toussaint introduced a whole host of new regulations, hoping to entice people back to work. For starters, the hated title of slave was abolished forever. Plantation workers now had the much more attractive title of cultivator. Corporal punishment was banned, there was mandatory time off, and most importantly, the cultivators would share in the profits of the plantation, 25% before expenses. It wasn't a terrible deal compared to what plantation workers in the rest of the New World were getting, but, that said, the labor would still be backbreaking. The same dangers still lurked in the cane fields. And perhaps most importantly, hardly any plantation in Haiti was turning a profit, and 25% of nothing is nothing. The cultivators who did return to the plantations did so begrudgingly. There are dozens of accounts of strikes and labor disturbances in the late 1790s. Oftentimes, Toussaint himself or one of his deputies had to ride out and personally convince the cultivators to return to work. Getting the plantations running again was more complicated than simply getting workers back into the fields. Buildings had to be rebuilt. Tools and machinery had to be repaired or replaced. Many of the irrigation systems which had made this land so fertile had been neglected and needed work. And where was the capital for all these investments supposed to come from? Agriculture on this scale is a sophisticated enterprise, and most of the people with the technical knowledge to make it work had come from Haiti's small, white, and mixed-race middle class, and most of them had either been killed in the rebellion or fled the colony. Toussaint wanted to attract as many of this class of people back to the colony as possible, and so he pursued a policy of reconciliation and unity. Despite the official French Republican policy that all émigrés were traitors, Toussaint let it be known that his government was willing to forgive past transgressions, in the interest of building a brighter future for everyone. This was Louverture in a nutshell. He was a strong believer in egalitarianism and racial unity, not only as abstract principles, but on a purely pragmatic level as the only way forward for a multiracial society situated at the crossroads of Africa, Europe, and the Americas. However, many found forgiveness for the former enemies of the revolution a bitter pill to swallow. There is a wide range of opinion on Louverture's internal economic policy. Some scholars have called it a failure, pointing out that during his time in power, the Haitian economy never even came close to recovering to its pre-revolutionary heights. Others have pointed out that given the degree of devastation after the war, it would have been impossible to bring the country back to prosperity in only a few years. They claim that given the terrible situation, Toussaint was actually pretty successful. I suppose it's a matter of perspective, but however you want to look at it, the Haitian economy remained a basket case throughout Toussaint's time in power. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply. He had more success in restarting the country's international trade. The most obvious trading partners were the British, who had the strongest economic presence in the region, and whose navy controlled the seas, on which all international commerce had to travel. But this was a dicey proposition. Britain and France were still at war, and there was widespread hatred of Britain among average Haitians, who remembered them as destructive foreign invaders who had fought to enslave the people. Instead, Louverture cozied up to the United States. American merchants had been a vital source of supplies during the war, and he was able to build on these relationships. Soon, American textiles and manufactured goods were appearing in Haitian markets, and Haitian cash crops could be seen at the ports of Boston and New York. Not for the first time, and certainly not the last, the Americans had reaped the benefits of sitting on the sidelines while their rivals fought it out. Within the first few years of Toussaint's rule, small communities of American merchants began to appear in Haitian port towns. General Louverture even started to get some positive press in American newspapers. Quite a feat in an era in which many white Americans lived in existential terror of slave revolts. Toussaint also began negotiations to open trade with the British, but these went slowly. There was bad blood here, and Louverture knew he had to tread carefully. He saw that Haiti would need British commerce and British investment to regain its economic footing, but he also saw that this would be a tough sell to people whose country had so recently been ravaged by invading redcoats. And he knew the British still harbored ambitions to dominate Haiti. In their negotiations with Toussaint, both the Americans and the British had a secondary political objective, encouraging the Haitians to declare independence from France. This would enable outside powers to pursue their economic goals in the colony without interference from Paris. Eventually, the US or Britain might be able to bring Haiti fully into their sphere of influence. It had proved impossible for outside powers to take Haiti by force, but perhaps they could enter through the back door, using economic power where military might had failed. Louverture was always consistent in declaring his loyalty to France. However, he never totally shut the door on these suggestions of independence. Perhaps he was simply being a good diplomat, humoring his American and British counterparts, and playing both sides against the French. Or perhaps he really did want to keep his options open. In 1798, a new governor arrived on the island to replace the hapless Sontenacs, General Gabriel de Edouville, a 43-year-old former aristocrat who had distinguished himself during the War of the First Coalition. Edouville was a tough customer. He had been one of the key leaders in the bitter counterinsurgency campaigns against the royalist rebels of western France. The appointment of a man like Edouville made the intentions of the government in Paris clear. They wanted to restore order in the colony, and their definition of order did not include an ex-slave general wielding absolute power. Edouville brought thousands of fresh troops from France with him. With the defense of the colony already well in hand, what purpose could these forces serve, other than to act as a counterweight to the power of Toussaint? Some of the motivation here may have been racism, but the French government probably also had some legitimate concerns about the idea of one man having total control over both the civilian administration and the military, and the fact that Toussaint and his army were almost all either native-born Creoles or Africans probably made them uneasy. Above all, they wanted Haiti to remain French. And no one currently in leadership had any personal ties to France. Louverture had never even set foot on the French mainland. What was really stopping him from declaring independence? His opinions? His interests? Those can change. And that surely caused concern in Paris. In his communications with Edouville, Toussaint was polite and magnanimous as always, claiming he was eager to form a partnership and work together. In practice, he treated the new governor like a rival from the very beginning. As soon as he arrived in Haiti, Edouville summoned General Louverture to a meeting. As the incoming governor, his obvious first priority would be to sit down with the man who was both the military chief of the colony and the most important local political figure. However, Toussaint kept him waiting for weeks. Edouville had to repeatedly pester him with letters. As I've mentioned, Louverture operated on the road, always mobile. Haiti is not a big place. It would have been easy for him to swing by the capital for a meeting with the governor. But he wanted to show Edouville who was really in charge here. Toussaint would meet the governor when it suited him, and not a moment sooner. And so, despite the flowery words on both sides, the relationship between the new governor and his senior general got off to a rocky start. Both men knew that beneath the polite facade, they were engaged in a struggle for power. Each immediately began working to undermine the other. Toussaint tried to make Edouville the scapegoat for all of Haiti's economic problems. He secretly encouraged the strikes and labor disturbances which had been bubbling up on the plantations, and ensured that it was the governor's name on the protesters' lips. Edouville countered by meddling in military affairs. He held back pay, equipment, and weapons from commanders close to Louverture, and lavished support on units that were known to be less loyal to the commander-in-chief, in hopes of weakening Toussaint's grip on the military. After a few months of this back and forth, that polite facade began to fall away. Both men began to countermand their rivals' orders, forcing their subordinates to choose who to obey. They stopped meeting in person, and their letters became increasingly hostile. In one of his letters to Eduville from this period, Toussaint wrote, quote, "You have been countering everything I do, slandering my every move, and casting doubt on all my proposals." End quote. It was all true, but Toussaint neglected to mention that he was doing much the same thing. Despite his frosty relations with Louverture, Eduville pressed ahead with his agenda of asserting French control over the colony. A key part of this agenda was demobilizing the troops which had fought the war against the British, and replacing them with the new all-white units recently arrived from Europe. This would tighten France's grip over the colony, at the expense of local Haitian leaders like Toussaint. Eduville's opening move was the dismissal of General Moïse, a popular black officer who just happened to be Toussaint Louverture's nephew. The dismissal came completely out of the blue, and provoked widespread condemnation among the local Haitian troops. Eduville had anticipated this. He used the outrage as proof that the locally raised units were politically unreliable and suffered from poor discipline. Under this pretext, he dispatched a force of his own European troops to Fort Liberté, a fortification in northern Haiti, with orders to disarm the garrison, and inform them that they too had been dismissed from the Republican army. The garrison welcomed Eduville's forces into the fort with open arms. But, once they learned of their mission, violence broke out. Eduville's men were prepared for a fight. The garrison was not. By the time the dust settled, 200 Haitian soldiers had been gunned down. They had survived the hellish war against the British, only to be taken unawares by their own governor. As news of the massacre spread, protests erupted across the country. The anger was real, but behind the scenes, Toussaint and his agents helped organize and direct public outrage. Finally, in a speech at Fort Liberté, the site of the massacre, Louverture publicly broke with the governor. Quote, "Who is the greater defender of your freedom? General Eduville, the former Marquis and Knight of Saint-Louis, or Toussaint Louverture, the slave from Breda?" End quote. You can imagine how the crowd answered. With encouragement from Louverture, these protests coalesced around a single unified plan to march on Cap Français and demand Governor Eduville resign in favor of his deputy, Toussaint Louverture. When the mass rally began in Cap Français, it quickly took on threatening overtones. People were very angry, and not unreasonably so. It seemed this protest would quickly spiral into a riot, or maybe something even uglier. Then, just at the pivotal moment, Toussaint Louverture arrived on the scene. If he'd wanted to, he could have ridden this wave of public outrage into power, forced Eduville out of office in a coup d'état, and taken the title of governor for himself. But that's not how Toussaint worked. He was a patient and subtle operator. He wouldn't use force to seize something when he could just as easily arrange for it to fall into his lap. Instead of taking command of the mob and storming the governor's palace, Louverture called for calm, and told the crowd he would ensure their concerns were heard as long as they refrained from violence. Toussaint had made his point. He had orchestrated this protest to demonstrate his power, and the demonstration had been so potent that he wouldn't need to actually exercise that power. Eduville caved. Moïse was reinstated, and the governor's plans to demobilize all locally raised Haitian military forces were put on indefinite hold. It seems the governor finally understood who really called the shots in Haiti. By the fall of 1798, Eduville was on a ship bound for France. He had lasted less than a year in the colony. He would be the last governor to give Toussaint any trouble. The next official representative of the French state in Haiti would be handpicked by Louverture himself, and, no surprise, he chose someone he knew to be loyal and pliant. Eduville was defeated, but before he left Haiti, he couldn't resist taking one last parting shot at his triumphant rival. He dashed off a letter to one of the colony's senior military leaders, General André Rigaud. In his last official act as governor, he granted Rigaud independent command, releasing him and his troops from General Louverture's authority. This act would have grave consequences.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
By 1798, André Rigaud was probably the most prominent mixed-race leader in the colony. At the outbreak of the rebellion, he had been a nobody, 30 years old, with no wealth and no public profile. But in the ensuing 7 years of chaos, his talents as a soldier had brought him to a position of de facto leadership over his entire community. Not unlike Toussaint, Rigaud had been on multiple sides of this conflict, before eventually deciding France represented his people's best chance for freedom. He operated in the south of the country, his home region, which contained the highest concentration of mixed-race people. The force Rigaud led is sometimes described as the army of the mixed-race community, and in a sense, that was true. It had originally been formed to fight for the rights of mixed-race Haitians, and the core of the leadership was almost all mixed race. However, from the very beginning, it had included a lot of black soldiers, and after the better part of a decade fighting for the Republican cause, a lot more black people, and even some whites, had joined the ranks. Rigaud was ambitious, and he and his comrades were not happy with the direction the country was taking under Louverture's leadership. With power increasingly concentrated around Toussaint, Rigaud and many of his circle felt they had been snubbed. Some of this was probably the natural consequence of one man gaining such tight control over the political system. Some of it was probably regional. There was a stark sectional divide between northern and southern Haiti. Toussaint and most of his inner circle were northerners. Rigaud and his clique were southerners. And, of course, there was a racial element. Not everyone shared Toussaint's views on race. Louverture believed all men and women were brothers and sisters, that race was an artificial division created by unscrupulous people for the purposes of profit and domination. These views are quite widespread today, but were held only by a minority in the late 18th century. For most people, race was very real, and especially in the New World, it was very important. Many mixed-race Haitians looked at Louverture's attempts to entice white refugees back to Haiti, his close relationship with white leaders like Governor Laveau, the presence of so many white officers and advisors in his staff, and his outreach to white France and white America, and they were concerned. To Louverture, this was all in the interest of building a new Haiti, which would be prosperous and free for everyone of every racial background. But many mixed-race Haitians saw it as a burgeoning alliance between the whites and the blacks. And many believed such an alliance could only result in the marginalization of the mixed-race community. Despite Rigaud's public embrace of Republican ideals, many of his mixed-race followers still privately saw themselves as the natural rulers of Haiti. They viewed whites as outsiders with no real roots in the colony, and blacks as an uneducated rabble, without the knowledge or skills to rule. And so, they resented Louverture, and had misgivings about this new Haiti he was trying to build. Rigaud was in touch with these sentiments, and more than willing to harness them for his own ambitions. Once he received Governor Eduville's letter releasing him from Louverture's command, Rigaud had a pretext to pursue those ambitions and challenge Toussaint in the open. And so, in the aftermath of the defeat of Toussaint's rival, a new rival immediately began to emerge. This new phase of Haitian politics represents one of the rare mistakes in Toussaint Louverture's career. He seems not to have truly understood the growing alienation and dissatisfaction among mixed-race Haitians, and to have underestimated the man who would give expression to all these negative feelings, André Rigaud. Rigaud and his supporters began to conspire. It was almost a mirror image of the conspiracy hatched by Macandal all those years ago. Macandal had organized the lowest of the low, field slaves and maroons. The men who conspired with Rigaud were near the top of society, military officers, plantation owners, and government officials. However, their plan was quite similar: to kill as many of their enemies as possible in one fell swoop, thus seizing control of the colony. Rigaud's uprising began in June 1799. All over northern Haiti, Rigaud's supporters took up arms, occupied strategic positions, and began to kill Louverture loyalists. 4,000 of Rigaud's best troops marched north from their bases in the south and began taking territory. Once again, Haiti descended into brutal violence. Rigaud and his men were outnumbered. The element of surprise helped compensate somewhat, but it seems they were also relying on terror to overawe their enemies. This terror often took on a racial character. Any prominent black or white person who fell into the hands of Rigaud's army was generally assumed to be a Louverture supporter. Many of them were tortured or outright massacred. For their part, as Toussaint's men scrambled to contain the uprising, they did much the same thing. Any mixed-race person was immediately suspected of conspiring with Rigaud. It seems Rigaud's plan was to quickly overwhelm Louverture's forces, move with such speed and such spectacular violence that his victory would look inevitable. With enough momentum, people might begin switching sides to get in good with the winning team. It kind of worked. There were defections from Toussaint's ranks, most notably General Alexandre Pétion, a future president of Haiti, who brought a sizable force over to Rigaud's side. However, despite their stunning success in the opening weeks of the uprising, the rebels didn't really come close to seizing control of the whole colony. Toussaint was too strong to be knocked out with a single blow, no matter how spectacular. He was too personally popular. There were too many devoted Louverture loyalists in key positions of the army and civilian administration. And Toussaint's vision of a racially united, democratic Haiti was very attractive, and a lot of people were willing to stand and fight for it, however terrifying the rebel onslaught may have been. And so, Rigaud's plan to seize the colony in one fell swoop failed. His invasion of the North stalled, and the pro-Rigaud uprisings behind Toussaint's lines were all suppressed. But that didn't mean the rebellion was over. It was now up to Louverture and his men to roll back the tide, push into the south, and force Rigaud to surrender. In his propaganda, Rigaud claimed his rebellion was a preemptive strike, that he had been forced to act after learning that Louverture was about to sell the country out to the hated British. There was a small kernel of truth within this lie. Toussaint was talking with the British in hopes of reopening trade, and had managed to squeeze a few concessions out of them. But he was hardly selling the country back into slavery. Ironically, Rigaud's forces were actually receiving a great deal of British support, money, supplies, and even weapons. On the other side, Louverture's new American friends had thrown their support behind his war effort. They even sent a squadron of naval vessels to join the fight against Rigaud, the beginning of a long and mostly shameful history of American military intervention in Haiti. While the great powers jockeyed for influence, the fighting on the ground was brutal. This period of Haitian history is known as the War of the Knives, and that gives you some idea of the level of violence. This was not a clean war. Massacres of suspected enemy sympathizers became routine on both sides. Few prisoners were taken. Much of the violence was carried out up close and personal with machetes. Only a year ago, these men had been comrades in the fight against Britain. Now, both sides felt the other had betrayed the cause, and so they treated each other like traitors. The violence and hatred unleashed in these dark days would cast a pall over Haitian politics for decades. Louverture had the numbers and the popular support, but Governor Eduville had spent almost a year offering preferential treatment to Rigaud's forces, and so the rebel troops were often better paid, trained, and equipped than Louverture's men. The fighting was hard and bitter, but by July 1800, Louverture was able to seize Rigaud's capital at Les Cayes. Rigaud and a small entourage fled the colony. The War of the Knives was over. It had lasted almost exactly a year, mercifully short compared to many other civil wars, but the damage it had wrought was almost incalculable. Tens of thousands more Haitians had died or been displaced, in a country that was already ravaged by war and could not afford to lose more citizens. There had been more destruction of property, agricultural land, and infrastructure. The rebel leaders had disproportionately come from the skilled and educated classes of the colony. Now they were all dead or in exile. These were the types of people Louverture needed to build his new Haiti, and now there were even fewer of them. But perhaps the most profound damage done by Rigaud's rebellion was to Haiti's internal politics. Toussaint and his supporters had worked hard to build an image of national unity. That image had been quite convincing in the face of a foreign invasion, but in peacetime, it had only taken a few months for internal divisions to reemerge. The war also had a profound personal impact on Toussaint Louverture. I tend to shy away from the so-called great man theory of history, but now that General Louverture is the undisputed master of Haiti, his personal views and mindset are actually quite important to the country's development. Toussaint had not seen this coming. He knew Rigaud was a threat and had tried to keep an eye on him, but had somehow missed a massive conspiracy right under his nose. Men he had once considered loyal had become turncoats. Obviously, this had been a political and military catastrophe, but Louverture must have also felt it as a personal failing. He was a master schemer in his own right, a man who prided himself on seeing all the angles and always staying two steps ahead of his rivals. But in this case, all his instincts seemed to have failed him, and he had nearly lost everything. Toussaint had always been secretive. Time and again, we've seen him play his cards close to the vest and keep his true intentions carefully guarded. But after the War of the Knives, that secretiveness started to verge on paranoia. Louverture trusted no one outside a very small circle of close advisors. He became increasingly isolated. Perhaps unsurprisingly, this period also saw Louverture become more authoritarian. Before Rigaud's rebellion, he had mostly been content to wield power informally, relying on people's personal loyalty to him and faith in his good judgment to get things done. But now, his faith in his people had been shaken, and so he sought to formalize and codify his control over the colony. As the War of the Knives was winding down, a ship arrived from France carrying momentous news. Once again, the government had fallen. The old Directory had been overthrown by a cabal of authoritarian centrist Republicans led by the Abbé Sieyès. Well, at least on paper they were led by the Abbé Sieyès. In practice, the leading figure in the new government was an ambitious young general named Napoleon Bonaparte. When it came to Haiti, the first act of the new government was to countermand former Governor Edouville's letter releasing Rigaud from General Louverture's command, and reconfirming Toussaint as commander-in-chief of all Republican forces in the colony, thus removing the legal pretext for Rigaud's rebellion. This order might have been very useful to Louverture a few months earlier, when it was first issued, but unfortunately for Haiti, it came far too late to prevent the slaughter. As he consolidated control over the government, Bonaparte began to signal a shift in colonial policy. Previous revolutionary governments had sought to erase any legal or practical distinction between the colonies and the French mainland. They believed they ruled in the name of universal principles. And so, it followed that the government of the revolution must be extended universally and apply equally to all French territory. It's hard to judge this approach. It's undeniably true that meddling from the revolutionary governments in Paris had produced a lot of chaos and violence in the colonies, especially in Haiti. However, this meddling had also resulted in the emancipation of the slaves and the successful defense of the colony against impossible odds. But Napoleon wanted to try a new approach. He promised there would be no more one-size-fits-all dictates from Paris, that laws and government policy in each colony would be tailored to unique local conditions. On the surface, it sounded like a liberal, pragmatic policy. But what did it really mean? Who would be doing this tailoring, and in service of what interests? As Louverture consolidated his rule over the colony, and Bonaparte consolidated his rule over France, Haitians could only watch and wait. I think we'll leave things there for now. Next time, we'll discuss Napoleon's colonial policy, and conclude the story of the Haitian Revolution. Until then, thanks for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.